It had the right to do so.
Presumably, it would have to have made the request in good faith, I would assume.
Well, I think under the UCC.
Because they were, there's got to be some concern about it. They just can't do it for an extraneous reason. It's sort of like you got to perform to somebody's satisfaction. That means good faith satisfaction. I think it doesn't mean.
I think you're right, Judge Garwood, under UCC 2609, which I'll turn to in a moment. Under the contract, though, I think it says that Flint Hills has the right to request evidence of title for any reason, though, in fact, it did have a reason. Yeah,
but, Mr. Lunsford, it seems to me that, you know, if you did that, then you could stop payment and ask for verification almost any time. I mean, there's got to be some threshold.
Right.
It may not be a very high threshold. It is clearly not as high as a reasonable threshold
right.
that the UCC, but there's got to be a threshold below which you just can't be silly about this.
I think that's right, Judge Garza. I think here the court imposed a far higher threshold than certainly the contract required, which was a minimal, if any, threshold. And certainly a higher threshold than what the UCC required, which I'll turn to in a moment.
But if under the contract you did, in fact, request assurance of title and they provided it, then you would have to make them whole, wouldn't you? In other words, if your suspension of performance had damaged them in any way, you would have to make them whole.
Hypothetically, that's right, Judge Owen, except that here they did not provide.
No, I'm just saying how the contract ought to work. In other words,
that's how it ought to work.
Even if you, for no reason, say every month, I want assurance of title on this condensate, and that delayed payment or whatever, you would have to make them whole if they did, in fact.
Through the payment of interest on the delay, yes.
Is that correct? I mean, and this is one of the questions that I had. I thought that you could withhold payment without paying the interest.
I think that's what it says.
I think the way it works is you have the right to request satisfactory evidence of title. If the information about title is lacking, you have the right to withhold payment and withhold performance. That goes from paragraph 5 to paragraph 14. If it's later determined that the information, that title is resolved satisfactorily or if the information is satisfactory, then your liability would be limited just to the interest on the delayed payment for the condensate.
Okay,
that's paragraph 5, I think.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Here, of course, the problem was the information was not sufficient. It was lacking. And that sort of ties to my second point under the contract, that they indisputably failed to provide satisfactory evidence of title. A key exhibit in this case is Plaintiff's Exhibit 2. This is the March 24th email from JAG, where they identify two of their suppliers, and then they promise to supply a contract showing PMEX, or PMEX's trading agent, selling to the first link in one of the chains. They promise that. They recognize that that's what they had to do to provide satisfactory evidence of title. But I think it's also undisputed that they could not do that. They eventually identified three suppliers.
Mr. Leminger, I thought there was some evidence that there were other distributors besides PMI in the United States, and in fact, in this case, were distributing to JAG.
Flint Hills.
Or to Flint Hills.
Well, yes. PMEX is the sole source, and it sells solely to PMI Trading down in Mexico. PMI Trading then sells to other people. The three suppliers that JAG identified, JAG was not a direct purchaser of either PMI or PMEX. It said we bought from Vagos, we bought from Castaneda, and we bought from, eventually they said we bought from Asfaltos. They could not provide a chain of title for any of those three back to either PMEX or PMI. Vagos, they identified an intermediate purchaser called Grupo. Grupo eventually said, well, look, we don't sell to Vagos, and we don't even buy from PMEX, so that was highly suspicious. Asfaltos, they said they had a contract, but their lawyer refused to provide it to us, and Castaneda refused to provide any information at all. So at all three with respect to all three of their alleged suppliers, they could not in any way trace the chain of title back to PMX or PMI.
The judge went on about tracing the molecules. You can't trace molecules in this kind of business, but as I understand it, you weren't asking anything more than who are your suppliers. Just identify who do you buy from. So you didn't have to look at each tank load. You weren't asking that. You just say who it is that you're buying from, and they got it, and then who did they get it from?
That's it.
So
that's all we asked for. And I think it's interesting that the district court just ignored or overlooked everything I just said about Vagos and Castaneda and Asfaltos. There's not a word in his oral opinion or written findings about that, and I think that's critical to this case. Plaintiffs Exhibit 2, their recognition of what they had to do and what, in fact, they were not able to do.
Mr. Hunter, one other question. If you went on the contract, everything else is moot.
Everything else is moot, right.
Now, we have to remand it back to the district court to enter. Well, we don't even have to do that. We can render.
Right. And the third element under the contract, Your Honors, is that the lack of information about title constitutes an event of default that allowed Flint Hills to withhold its performance as a matter of law. That's paragraph 14. The court ignored that provision entirely. There's just no reference to it at all in the opinion. So in short, we didn't breach the contract as a matter of law, and the contract permitted us to do precisely what we did. I think you reached the same result under UCC 2609, although you don't need to reach it, and the analysis is somewhat different. Under the first element of 2609, we did have reasonable grounds for insecurity. This court's Clem Perrin case from, I think, 1980.
Let me ask you, does 2609 apply? I mean, this contract speaks about evidence of title. It says some things about that.
Right.
Why doesn't that control the case, whether it's favorable to you or it wouldn't seem that the UCC would apply where a contract says something about it.
I agree with that. And that's why we briefed the contract first and said we should prevail based on the contract
by
itself.
Well, I don't think it's who prevails. It doesn't seem to me that that's the question. It seems that the question is the UCC says this is the rule unless you talk about something else and give another rule in the contract.
Right.
At least that's implicit in the UCC.
I think that's
so
right.
So if you don't win under the contract, you don't win under the UCC because the contract has spoken to this general area.
Well, that's the part I disagree with, Judge Garwood. If we don't win under the contract, it's because the contract doesn't govern this particular situation, that it doesn't give us the right to suspend performance, and that's that's why you should look to the UCC.
But if you have a contract that says what you do when you're worried about title, and it doesn't give you a right to suspend performance, says you don't suspend performance, you do this instead, then that's going to govern. The UCC is not going to govern. It's not going to override the contract.
No, and we're not asking it to override the contract. No. I think we're just saying that it provides an alternative way of getting to the same result. And, in fact, that was the case in Clem Perrin. The court initially said, does the contract control this situation? The court held it did not. So it went on and looked at UCC 2609. Okay,
but implicit in the court's ruling is that the contract does control this situation. And nobody disputes that.
Well,
in other words,
yes.
Now, obviously, you want to argue the alternative, okay?
I do.
But it seems to me that even arguing the alternative, it's a higher threshold. If you lose on the contract, you're going to lose on the UCC, it seems to me.
Well, not necessarily if you follow their argument. And their argument is, yes, the contract did allow us to request evidence of title. Yes, the contract required them to provide it. But no, it doesn't. No matter what they do, even if they don't provide satisfactory evidence of title, it doesn't allow us to suspend performance. That's their argument. It just doesn't give us the remedy that we're seeking under UCC 2609. I don't buy that argument. I think they're wrong. But if they're right, then I think the court would have to look to UCC 2609 because it provides us the remedy that we claim we're entitled to, the right to suspend performance. And, yes, it is a higher standard, but I think we can meet it. The first element is, did we have a reasonable ground for insecurity? This is where I think Clem Perrin is so controlling, and I think it demonstrates that the court erred in at least three respects with respect to that first element about reasonable insecurity. First, under Clem, the court erred in emphasizing that JAG itself was not linked to the thefts. The court kept saying, you haven't proven that JAG itself was linked to the thefts. Well, Clem Perrin says that the grounds for insecurity do not need to arise from the party's contract or from their relationship. And the example the commentators give is if the price of a commodity is rising, the buyer of that commodity has the right to ask the seller to provide assurance, even though the seller may have done absolutely nothing to give any reason for insecurity. That's the hypothetical that the commentators give to illustrate that point. I think our facts are far more compelling and far less speculative than even that hypothetical. The second error the court made was in holding that Flint Hills allegedly overreacted to these unreliable reports about thefts. Here, I think the court ignored the holding in Clem that you only need to have a reasonable doubt, not absolute certainty, in order to have grounds for insecurity. In fact, the UCC comments 3 and 4 say that your source need only be apparently trustworthy.
Well, but here there's another element, and that is that it's a generalized. The notice was that there's theft.
Mm-hmm.
The notice did not say that from that theft, JAG sold to Flint Hills.
Well,
in other words, there's a possibility and nothing more, and it never tied JAG into that possibility.
Nor did I think it needed to under the facts of this case and under the law in Clem Perrin. Well, first of all, Clem Perrin says that the insecurity doesn't have to arise from the contract between the parties. It can arise more generally, like the hypothetical, a price increase. Here, you know, when they get information that there are thefts of condensate down in Mexico from the Pemex production facilities, then the question is, you know, my gosh, we know you're not buying directly from PMX or PMI. JAG admitted that. So then the question is, what can you give us, you know, a link? Can you link your title back to PMX or PMI? And they knew they had to do that.
My question is that so general that it would encompass almost anything under the UCC? And it's got to be reasonable.
Right.
You know, that's the threshold.
Right.
And I'm not.
I don't think it's that general. I think it's sufficient to cause concern of any corporation, particularly a responsible corporation, that they need to do something.
Mr. Levenger, you have 5 minutes left on your rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Moose.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Marvin Moose, representing JAG Energy. Also with me is Mr. Jim Ebanks, who was trial counsel in this case. Basically, what you were just asked to do is to retry a bench trial. They want you to reevaluate the witnesses. They want you to reevaluate credibility. They want you to reweigh evidence. They want you to say, we disagree with the way the district court ruled in this case, and turn it around. Zenith Radio and the Anderson Supreme Court cases in Rule 52 say that's not the standard. You can't do it that way. They also argue that the district court incorrectly applied legal principles. They're trying to slot this in to the narrow exception under the clear error standard. I still don't know what legal principle was incorrectly applied.
How about the reading of the contract?
The reading of the contract is fairly clear. I understand their argument on that.
I mean, they're just wrong.
You would
acknowledge that the word reasonable is no place in that contract, would you? Under 5 or 14?
Under 5 or 14, no. There is not a reasonable standard, except if you look at the one sentence in paragraph 5 that they are focusing in on. They are focusing in on the question of whether there was an adverse claim, lien dispute, or other lack of information. Lack of information is pretty vague. Thus, the district court had to hear evidence of what exactly did you claim you lacked before you, A, on March 24th, suspended deliveries, and then again on March 27th, suspended payment.
Well, but I mean, this is that's part of it. The next part, it says, if requested, seller agrees to furnish evidence of title satisfactory to buyer. Now, it seems to me that that's a pretty low threshold, and it is clear also that the district court made findings of fact that had nothing to do with the requirements listed in the contract. You know, that Jack stole it, the condensate, I forget what the other findings that he made. Just a minute. Well,
that Jag didn't steal it. He didn't find that Jag.
Yeah, that Jag didn't steal it, that Aranda never said he
stole
it.
Well, but there was a connection, that he had to prove a connection between that Flint was somehow in, you know, that there had to be some more proof than that was required in the contract.
At the time they suspended deliveries, Judge Garza, and locked us out of our facility, they had not yet received any title information.
Well,
they just hauled off, locked the doors, and said, we are suspending payments. 3 days later, they said, we're going to suspend deliveries also. They rejected all future offers.
13 paragraph, 13, 14, and 18 in the findings of fact, are any of those found in the contract?
13, 14, 18, Your Honor?
Yeah.
13 is. That's a direct quote out of paragraph 5. The second sentence of it was just a factual finding saying that an adverse claim did not exist to the condensate.
Well, but is that required? I mean, is that required in the contract that there's an adverse claim?
It is under the sentence before. There's two sentences in paragraph 5.
No, I thought that you have adverse claim, lien, dispute, or lack of information affecting or concerning title to property.
Or to the crude oil proceeds from the lands described in the agreement.
Right.
Then buyer may withhold payment until the claim, lien, dispute, or lack of information is resolved without liability for interest. That's all that is. That's all it does is cut off interest.
Mr. Smith,
I apologize.
You don't need an adverse claim. You can have lack of information could be sufficient. It seems to me from reading that it gives adverse claim, it gives a lien, gives a dispute, or lack of information.
And
in other words, he read it wrong. He read the contract wrong. Now, I think, you know, the UCC portion of it, I think, is pretty strong. But he almost... What do you call the word? What's the word? He flopped the UCC requirements onto the contract.
I respectfully disagree. I don't think he did. I really do not. Okay, it was poorly phrased to limit that second sentence to adverse claim. But if you look at it, what he was looking at was, what was your information? What did you know before you locked them?
This is a pretty large commercial contract. And even when a consumer goes out to buy a car or a big purchase, most contracts say you have the right to have title information furnished or you don't have to go through with the deal. Now, what is so unusual and what is wrong with enforcing a contract as written? I suspend payment until you can prove title. It seems to me they could ask every month for your title, and that would not be a breach, and you're obligated to furnish it.
Sure, they can ask for it every month. The evidence in this case was tried on course of performance, okay? Tried under course of performance, Judge Garwood. In addition to what the contractual terms were, there was evidence on how the parties operated under this contract.
So that if I don't ask for title for the first 6 months, I waive my right thereafter to ask for proof of title?
Not at all, Your Honor. What I was going to say was that under the course of performance and the way this contract had been done, they had provided the huge volumes that they had been providing, they had not provided title. Now, when it comes down to the request for title, They gave them all this information to start with, bear in mind. There's evidence of that. They had all the importer, exporter, and transporter information from the get-go and said, okay, we'll accept it, bring it on. Give me everything that you can give us. The testimony at trial said, it basically said that sometimes you cannot come up with a paper trail for every truck of condensate.
Nobody ever asked them to. Wait a minute. The district judge got all off the map when he started to talking about molecules of gas, that they have vehicle identification numbers. Because they didn't have vehicle identification numbers on gas, then you can't ask for anything. I think that's silly.
Okay. I believe...
What they asked for, as I understand it, was who are you buying your gas from, and who are they buying it from, and are they buying it from Pemex or PMI, or are they buying it from somebody who's buying it from them? That was it, wasn't it?
That's their argument, and what happened was the JAG people provided as much title as they could under these facts.
Now, wait a minute. They admitted they didn't provide as much information as they could, and the judge said everybody knows that a supplier doesn't like to provide information as to who he's getting it from because somebody might then run around him, as indeed the plaintiff here did.
Yeah, they did.
And buy from that person. And that's what he hung his judgment on. Because they wouldn't tell him. These enemy people says, we ain't going to tell you who we got it from. Mm-hmm. And the district judge says, that's perfectly good. Because otherwise these Foothill people might run around them. But the problem is the contract don't say that.
That goes into the lack of information issue, I believe, is what the judge is looking at there. They never proved the lack of information on this one.
They proved that these people would not tell them who one of these earlier identified intermediate suppliers would not tell them who they were getting it from.
Some of the intermediate suppliers refused to divulge their sources on the condensate only, Judge Garwood. Bear in mind,
what we were talking about is condensate.
Oh, the damages weren't based totally on condensate. The damages were based on delivery of Mexican product under this contract, which included dark oil. If in Defense Exhibit 14, and the court's damage numbers are based all on line item entries in Defense Exhibit 14, which includes condensate and dark oil. They had title information on the dark oil before they filed the interpleader, yet they still withheld the payment for that.
That's not the damages that were awarded. Maybe they included dark oil, but you can't affirm the award on that basis.
There was no lack of title on the dark oil.
But the damages were included damages for condensate, didn't they, or did they?
Yes, they did.
So my question is, can you then affirm the judgment for everything that which includes condensate, which you haven't furnished information on?
Yes, because under a clearly erroneous standard, I do not believe that the trial court erred. I don't think they have still fitted into the narrow exception. And Judge Owen, you ruled on this in the Bertucci case just recently, a year or so ago, where they tried to argue that in the Elysian case on the Mississippi River that, no, we look at the legal principles. And the district court erred in applying rules 9 and 14 on the narrow channel passage rules. And you said, no, yes, that is, you said, yes, that is the test. But under the evidence the district court could plausibly credit, it still falls under the clearly erroneous standard, and we don't find it to be clear error.
Well, that was as applied to conflicting facts, and here the facts are undisputed as to what was said when. I guess my question is, one question I have is, if we were to disagree with you about the interpretation of the contract, where would that leave us? You've mentioned dark oil. Would we have to remand? And if so, to resolve what?
If you disagree with us and agree with Flint Hills on the contractual issue.
On the construction of the contract.
That
they had the right to ask for adequate assurance of title. They didn't get that. Where does that leave us? Do we remand for?
Yeah, I think it would have to be a total remand.
To resolve what issues?
Well, the dark oil's resolved. They didn't appeal that. That portion of the that,
well, it's
that
not before us.
All they appealed is that are complaining about condensate title. I don't see a single I don't see a single issue that says the damages were incorrectly divided up.
Why are we arguing about dark oil if that's not before us?
Because I apologize. I skipped ahead to one of their points. One of their issues is the damages are incorrect because of the district court based it on too many barrels per day. And the district court did not base the damages on more than 1,000 barrels a day of condensate. That's where we're going on that one.
But if they could not lawfully charge for condensate when they hadn't provided the title information as requested, if that's correct, then the district court should not award them damages for condensate. Did the district court award them damages for not paying for condensate?
For future deliveries. The past deliveries that they requested title on, they were part of the interpleader funds. Once they interpled them into the court and the court dispersed them from the registry, that resolved paragraph 5.
All right. What about the future funds?
The future was, well, you can't provide title on something you haven't bought yet.
But
and he said nothing.
You don't have to accept condensate in the future until these people provide you the information that what they're selling you, they have title to.
They didn't let us do that. And that's what the court found. The court found.
Did you ever supply the information? Who wouldn't let you supply the information?
Flint Hills. They locked us out. They would not allow a truck into the property. There was no way to deliver it. And that's what Judge Hughes found. He said we had past delivered condensate, past delivered dark oil. You proved title on the oil. The condensate issue was put into the registry of the court. The court independently found that the contract did not allow Flint Hills to reject the future deliveries.
Mr. Moose, I thought I had read this pretty carefully, and I cannot, and I'm going through your damage argument.
You're right.
It's not dark oil is not there.
You're right. It's
frustrating.
I apologize, Judge. If you go to Defense Exhibit 14, this was something in preparing for oral argument, we realized we did not clarify it as well as we should.
And because I read them, too. It was before Thanksgiving. But I thought your argument was, well, we're not limited to $1,000 a day because they bought more than that consistently every month, and we're entitled to the reasonable expectation of what we would have sold.
That is accurate.
So let me put it to you again. If we disagree with you on the contract issue and rule as a matter of law, they had the right to request title information, and they didn't get it. Do we need to remand? And if so, what issues are there left to resolve?
I think it has to be a total reanalysis of what happened under paragraph 5. If the court is saying that the district court erroneously applied paragraph 5, it still requires some type of factual resolution, and I think the court needs to resolve
What are the facts to be resolved? That's where I don't understand. What facts would have to be resolved?
Their argument, it was a default, and the default is the adverse claim paragraph or lack of information paragraph that Judge Garza pointed out was not clearly stated in the findings. Okay, and the court resolved that, and that should be a clear error analysis, all right?
Resolved what? That's what I don't understand.
They resolved the lack of, they said they had no lack of information to request title, or to suspend payment. They relied entirely on Aranda, a competitor statement who had previously gone around them with the exact participants in this case, with Rhonda Schlatter, with Flint Hills, and Rodrigo Aranda with PMI. Those two individuals went around JAG before. He had that. Their argument is we're entitled to rely on Mr. Aranda because he's a senior official with PMI. Well, that ignores the competitor status.
Reliance. They're not relying on anything. They want a question resolved.
We kind of jumped over to the UCC issue. I'm just
talking about the contract.
Okay. All right.
The contract says that you're supposed to furnish information if they ask for it about the title, and that then the paragraph 14 of the contract says if you fail to make any performance under this contract, then the other party shall have the right to withhold payment or deliveries.
As an offset. Yes. 14 is a right of offset. It's not a default. Here is what the district
says, default or other performance. If they don't perform, the other party doesn't have to.
Sure, you can withhold it and offset it.
Deliveries.
And withhold it and offset it. What happened on March 24th? On March 24th, on that day, what did Flint Hills know? Flint Hills knew Aranda said somebody's stealing vague, unidentified oil in Mexico.
A little bit more than that because as I understand the evidence in this case, they went to their Washington attorneys, you know, and there was at least a risk. They went to Mexican attorneys. They confirmed that there was some investigation on these thefts that had occurred. I for one think it's a little bit too general as far as the UCC is concerned. But there was some question, and at least it's a good faith question. It seems to me that we want to know where we're getting where you're getting this condensate, and. So there was a little bit more than just Aranda. I mean, they did try to confirm at least the thefts.
I agreed, but didn't. If you look at the actual evidence of what they looked at, all they verified was that Pemex was conducting an investigation
of thefts.
But it was confidential. We don't know where. We don't know what facility. We don't even know what product. All right,
they were saying from the wells.
They said
that's in evidence, I believe, from the wells.
But which wells? They didn't identify the wells. Right.
Didn't identify the lease even.
Exactly. Somebody's driving a truck back in back country
that produced condensate and oil.
Yes. All Washington said was it's illegal to sell stolen property. Okay, well, no one ever tied this back to JAG, and I think the district court properly concluded that that was no basis for reasonable insecurity.
Let me ask you this. Did the district court find that Flint Hills acted in bad faith?
No, they found commercial unreasonableness.
Okay.
That's what it was. It was, and it wasn't an absolute certainty. They just said you're commercially unreasonable.
Okay, all right. But the contract does not require commercial unreasonableness or reasonableness, does it?
Not per se, but as you pointed out when Mr. Levenger was arguing, Judge, that you have to have some basis to question
that. I think you can't do it in bad faith. You must be honest that this is what you really wanted. You want to find out.
That ties in, and I see my red light's up. May I continue?
That's not the case.
May I continue? My red light's up, Judge.
Yes.
Judge Garwood's question?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. I think that ties in with what Judge Owen said, that if you do indeed agree with Flint Hill's construction of the contract and find that that takes it out of the clearly erroneous standard and puts it into the narrow exception that Judge Hughes misapplied the law, I think that has to be part of the remand then. The decision that has to be part of – if you're going to remand that, you have to remand the question – of good faith versus bad faith, if you're saying that is an element of this.
Well, he certainly didn't make any finding of bad faith, did he?
I see a finding of commercial unreasonableness. I don't see a finding of bad faith. No, Your Honor.
And that wasn't even an issue that was brought up.
No.
By
no,
anybody.
The only allegations of bad faith down below were attributed to Aranda and PMI.
Okay.
And that's it. And for the reasons that we stated in our brief and here today, Your Honor, we request that you affirm the judgment of the district court and assess reasonable and necessary attorney's fees on appeal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mercer.
Thank you.
Mr. Levenger.
Well, I think the court understands my position. I just want to briefly respond to this dark oil versus condensate position. This is a distinction that I think is an artificial one, and yes, it has been raised for the first time on appeal. You will see nothing in the brief about any sort of distinction between dark oil and condensate. And the reason for this, I think, is demonstrated under Plaintiff's Exhibit 4, which is tab 12 to our record excerpts. This is an email chain, and in it, the in-house lawyer from Flint Hill says, I would be glad to review any documentation that can show the complete chain of title for the dark oil. And the response from JAG's attorney is, already sent everything y'all need. We are unwilling to disclose identities of suppliers, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not true that they provided evidence of title with respect to either the dark oil or the condensate for that matter. There is no basis for distinguishing between the two for purposes of damages or otherwise. And if this court should conclude that we have the right to do what we did under the contract and they did not have the right to do what they didn't do under the contract, then the court should reverse and render the plaintiff take nothing. There's just no basis for distinguishing between the condensate or the dark oil.
Well, I mean,
that's the only point I wanted to make on rebuttal, unless the court has any further questions for me.
This wasn't brief. I do have a question. When you're dealing with commodities like this, where you can't identify your fungible goods, basically, right. And as long as you can show that you purchased in good faith from someone who apparently had title, or they purchased from someone who had title, do they have to trace it farther back to show that you've got good title under the law, even if maybe the condensate was originally stolen? Are you a good faith purchaser down the line so that the title doesn't have to go any further back? I mean,
Judge Owen, I think in a case like this, what you have to do, given that PMX is the sole supplier and given that PMI Trading is the sole buyer from PMX, you have to be able to trace your chain of title back to either PMX or PMI to alleviate any concerns about theft. And JAG knew that. That's what they offered to do.
I mean, is there something special about this kind of condensate that?
No. No. I think that would be true with respect to any petroleum product.
As I understand it, is that nobody owns any oil or condensate in Mexico other than PMX originally. In other words, anything that came out of the ground and didn't go to PMX, there's something bad about it.
That's it. They're the sole supplier of
my
all.
My question is, I guess I've never really understood, why is it important that it's Mexican condensate as opposed to Texas condensate or Oklahoma condensate?
Well, that's what this contract called for.
Is it a special grade or quality, or is there something physically different about this condensate? I was just curious.
That I don't know, other than that the contract specifically said we want Mexican condensate. It was identified as Mexican condensate, which everybody understood came from PMX.
And I would presume that PMI is the Mexican subsidiary that is the exclusive agent here in the United States for the sale of this type of condensate.
I don't think that's exactly right. I think what they are is an affiliate of PMX that's the exclusive marketing arm. In other words, PMX sells exclusively to PMI Trading in Mexico, and whether PMI Trading is authorized to sell in the United States, I'm not exactly sure. They may well be, but it's probably equally the case that they sell to somebody else in Mexico, and then that somebody else exports it and imports it.
No claim in this case, I understand, from JAG or anybody else that this, what they were selling was not Mexican.
Correct.
In other words, whatever condensate or oil or anything is being sold is stuff that was produced in the nation of Mexico.
Right. It had to have been to meet this contract requirement.
And nobody has got any right, in a sense, to that other than PMX and those to whom it sells.
Sure. That's exactly right.
Thank you, Mr. Bull.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We have your case under submission. Next case is Lexington Insurance versus